It's always a pleasure talking with someone who has recently been to a meditative retreat where they have calmed their beating heart, listened only to the sound of the breeze, and allowed their thoughts quietude. From inner peace comes outer peace. We are not disconnected from our spiritual selves, though most of us may be unaware of these many connections. In this podcast with Tanya, we look into some of these themes and touch on other questions that have always floated around in our minds. Talking about peacefulness in a world of chaos seems indulgent in some ways. It is, however, impossible to attempt to exist without trying to find a place of solitude and comfort that would allow us to continue. It is the hope of our podcast that by speaking of peacefulness, of spirituality, of respect, of common and universal values, that people will seek paths of similar kind and not the thorny ways of hate, anger, and discrimination. It is my hope that we will seek wisdom. Wisdom has long sought us and found the door tightly closed. It is time to let wisdom in and for us to be willingly open. Thanks, Tanya, for your time. Two and a mic, clocking out. Enjoy.
Jepek kudwelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawo yetu under mic. Seche tin sud buta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed piny biwawinje. Erochako dumomit ndi podcast makende.
You will notice that we jumped straight into the podcast here because I didn't really want to edit out the pre-podcast conversation that I was having with Tanya. It was such a relevant chat to the rest of the podcast that I decided to keep it in there. So we have foregone our normal introduction and just jumped straight into it. So once again, enjoy.
Only through my travels, I had the chance to really identify or find my identification as a European, you know?
I mean, that's also quite interesting because we talk about realities. I don't travel well. Yeah, I'm like a cheap wine. I should basically just stay where I am. Because I know that there are lots of people who were just simply born with visa application forms and they go everywhere the whole time. I can't stay on holiday for more than a week or 10 days. I start to lose my hair. I mean, look, yeah. I think for me, it's not necessarily the place that I go to. For me, it's the people. I don't know. As in, I don't need to be on the other side of the planet, even though I love different cultures, but it's just interacting with people, and as long as I can do that, I will find a home of some sort.
Well, that's beautiful, and I think it's worth a lot that you know that about yourself, you know. So like, there's no need that you are like whipping yourself like, I need to go and travel the world and conquer other places if you feel uncomfortable, or if you feel more comfortable doing having other sorts of exploration, you know. With me, I do feel comfortable, which doesn't mean that I am not scared. I had like my very first big trip was after my Abitur, after I turned 18, A-levels. I spent 6 months in Australia and New Zealand, and I wanted to go there, and I worked my beep off, got to save money to go there. And when I was finally sitting in the plane, I burst out in tears. I remember I had to pull my hoodie over my head because I was ashamed about my tears. I was crying so much because I got scared of my own courage, you know, like, oh, fuck, what am I doing? Where am I going? And I had the same thing, like more or less 10 years later on my way to Indonesia, where I was even, you know, I was older. I've been traveling even more, but there also that happened. So, yeah. So it's not that it comes all easy peasy, happy chappy, but it's like, it is also like it's a learning process also for a person who really loves traveling. Yeah,
we need to speak with the people who have taught you to say easy peasy and happy chappy. This is fundamental English here.
Easy peasy is something I know for a long time. Happy chappy I have from my significant other.
I had a feeling there was a significant other. We could have to speak with your significant other. It's good to hear that he's a happy chappy, but that's cool. I think it's people, your emotions, I mean, who knows, you obviously know the reason behind your outpouring of emotion when you go on these big trips. I guess you say your fear of your own courage, but it could also be perhaps ecstasy at the at what lies ahead, finally getting to do something that perhaps you'd been waiting for a long time. And it's just as you take off, it's the relief which sort of flows from your journey.
That is also a probability. And I was just, when I was listening to what you said now, I was like, there's a fundamental change in not only the way I travel, but also like the place I go. I like to go to travel because before, I loved a lot to go to places where I have never been. You know, first time there. And as I said before, like Thailand is one of the countries where I've been back now for the fifth time. And so I really like this feeling of being home or knowing my way around in another country. And I mean, I am also visiting consequently and consistently the same places when I go there. So like it's the fifth trip to Thailand, and it is the fifth time that I went to this Buddhistic temple, to the monastery, to do a meditation retreat. You know, so I don't do every time exactly the same, obviously, but there are like cornerstones which I repeat because they do me good. And then from there I take it. So it's always I continue. So it's always it's a really nice, very healthy mixture and a way of traveling to find something known in the unknown and to find also unknowns in the unknown. So.
Because obviously I'd like to hear a bit more about the meditation. I've read quite a bit about meditative retreats. I also have spoken with somebody else, Lilek. She often goes to France, where there is also a similar place. I will try to remember it in a moment. I'm terrible when it comes to remembering names. But she also goes to meditate. I mean, is it a silent meditation? Can you communicate while you're there? What is it extremely personalized? Do you have a word count? I don't know.
No, I don't have a word count. So the temple in northern Thailand where I go regularly is a Vipassana meditation center. So they practice Vipassana and teach Vipassana. And you have the opportunity, you have two choices. One choice is you go directly in the monastery, and then you have a monk, a Thai monk, as a teacher for your daily reporting, or you go to the affiliated international center where you have foreigners, like non-Thais, who are then teaching you. So this is two different things. And it is quite common in Thailand. It's actually a big part of the culture that Thais go for a weekend, for a week, for a couple of months to live in a monastery and to practice. So this monastery where I have been, I just talk a bit, and if you have questions, you just go in. So because you said you are like a bit to understand the setting. So if you go there and you have never, like you barely know how to write Vipassana or how to spell it, then what you do, you start with a 3 weeks course. Yeah, and this is where they teach you how to meditate. And the meditation they practice in that temple is, or a monastery is, walking meditation and sitting meditation. So you go up, they teach you up to 1 hour of walking meditation and 1 hour of sitting meditation. So one round of meditation is 2 hours at a certain point. And in this 3 weeks, they bring you there. You start with 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes, and you go up. So, and once you have this 3 weeks, then you go back for the retreat. And the retreat is always the same structure, and there's always 10 days, 8 days plus 48 hours. And there are no like really strict rules with regard, for example, of the talking or speaking, but there are certainly a recommendation. So the recommendation is everything which distracts your mind. So no talking is considered the best, or at least the less possible talking. No reading, no writing, journaling. If possible, do not leave the monastery compound. So do not interact with others, because you get a lot of information from the outside, you know, energy and everything. That is one thing. Then one of the rules you agree upon is that you dress only in white. You should refrain from beautification, use of perfume, makeup, jewelry. Like you are basically there pure. And that with the white stuff is also one reason to wear only white, is so that you don't get busy in your head. Oh, how do I look today? You know, so it's everybody's in white. Another thing you agree or you obey when you have your opening ceremony at the beginning is that you have the same eating times as the monks and the nuns. And that means you have breakfast at 6, you have lunch at 11, and after 12 like p.m. you do not eat anymore until the next morning, 6 a.m. when there is breakfast.
So there's no dinner.
There's no dinner. No, you are allowed, like, and it's about not to intake something, you have to chew. You can have coffee, you can have tea, you can have fruit smoothies, you can have hot chocolate, you know, you can also put honey in your tea. You can drink whatever you want, like no alcohol, obviously. And but you should refrain from eating. Why? Because it keeps your body busy.
Eating.
Yeah, eating and digesting.
Yeah.
Digesting the food is keeping your body busy, and you should, like, it is a very extraordinary, it's very extraordinary circumstances and environment, actually very luxurious in the way that you can solely, if you go there, you have the chance, which you don't have in your daily life, to solely focus on your practice. And that results then also that the average of meditation I did in this last retreat was between 10 and 14 hours per day. And you can't do that. Like, you should try to meditate as much as possible. And you can't do that if you get distracted by preparing food, buying food, going for food, you know, chit-chatting here and there. And maybe if you're interested, like how the day looks like, I can say something on that.
Like, yeah, of course. I'm just thinking to myself, I mean, because there's another podcast I'm hopefully going to bring out later on today. But in that, also I make reference to the number of disturbances that our minds have to deal with, even without us actually realizing, from the moment we wake up until the moment we go to sleep, as in our mind is constantly absorbing information either by sight, sound, smell, touch, and so on. And the meditation just completely reduces that to the most minimal values, I guess.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it is really interesting, Zach, after such a retreat, when I step out of them, and this had been now my sixth retreat there, and it's every time the same. When you come out of the retreat and I step out of the monastery compound, only standing on the road, listening to the traffic, listening to the usual, as you said, usual voices and impressions you have around you, I get overwhelmed. I have to retreat to the monastery back, because your mind gets really, really all sensitive, and only then I understand what I am actually doing to my mind, bombarding it every day, you know. And this is not about scrolling on social media. It's like on a daily basis. It's as you actually said. Yeah.
I mean, this, without meaning to sound too dramatic about it, but maybe it's something that in a couple of generations we will get used to. But I mean, this does appear to be a potential factor for the presence of so much stress in our daily lives. I mean, you can also talk about all of the other issues, work and responsibilities and so on. Of course, these are issues, but our minds are so constantly occupied by identifying what's going on around us. Perhaps this also just leads us to being stressed without us knowing about it at all. And another consequence, I read yesterday a stark statistic which said that one in four people around the globe have or have had mental health issues. 25% of the globe, that's a significant quantity of people.
Yes, absolutely. And for me, there are different means and ways one can find to cope with it. But in order to want to cope with it, you need to have a consciousness about it, you know. And this is the first step. I know that when I went the first time to that monastery was 23 years ago, I wasn't aware of all the, let's say, pollution I get into my mind or I let in, because it's considered normal. Only when I left that monastery back then for the very first time, I had this overwhelming experience of oh no, I need to go back, I want to hide, which is also not a solution. But only if you have you reach a point where you are that's how it is and it's not good for me and I want to change it, that's only when you can go and start looking for a possible solution for yourself. And they look different. Like for me, they look different than for you, than for others.
A couple of times when I've been sick for a certain period of time, at least 2 or 3 days, and I haven't actually moved, I've stayed at home. The first time that I set my foot outside the front door, that first step, sometimes I actually consciously have to make the decision, now move, you got to go, take that step, because there's a resistance. I'm like, no, I was okay at home. I don't want to take the step, you know? And the longer that I may have been at home isolated, the more severe that first step resistance is. So when you said that, I had to go back in, without sounding odd, I'm not trying to say, yeah, I've done it, as in, I think I know a part of how you may have felt.
Yeah, that's what I hear. Yeah, that's exactly it's interesting because you have it looks like you have the same experience that you it's a bit like we have to push ourselves then, no? You're like, okay, go and face your life. I mean, you can't always hide at home and I can't always hide in the monastery, And my experiences what I did is now when I'm in the monastery, I integrate a buffer. So I came out of my retreat and then I allowed myself to stay for another 3 days in the monastery. Because I couldn't have handled even the idea to have my final reporting in the morning of the 10th day and then leave in the afternoon would make me freeze, So I could go back a bit more to what for me is like normal living circumstances and enjoy a bit more the peace of the monastery and be there with the monks and the nuns and the other students. And then after 3 days, I went out to the next biggest town. And then from there, I actually did, and that was the second time I did that. I went to an island where I stayed for 2.5 weeks. And that is a very, it's not such a busy island. It's a rather small island. No cars are driving there. And you do have a travel community there. But it's not like, let's say, hardcore tourism where you have a lot of impact on your mind. And so I was there, it was only me and the beach and the sea and the trees and the nature, so that I could, that I wanted to give myself a chance to integrate my experiences and to let them sink in. And I know I can't do that. I couldn't have done that going straight from the monastery, let's say, to Bangkok. Yeah, or to one of the bigger islands, yeah. So to find one's way, how to handle those kinds of situations is quite important, I guess.
Yeah, and the name of the retreat in France, it's Plum Village. It just came to my mind.
What kind of village? Which village?
Plum.
Plum? Oh.
Plum Village, yeah. And I think I'm terrible. I'm really bad with names, but I think the person who established it was Thich Nhat Hanh. It's a name that you are, you know this
yes.
because you've quoted him a few times. And so therefore, I know you are familiar with him. Yeah.
I will have a look at that village. I don't know that village, but I will have a look after our talk.
I always used to get it wrong when I spoke with Ilik. I used to refer to it as Plum Valley, and she'd laugh at me. She said, "I'm sure there's a valley there somewhere, but it's actually a village." but yeah, I mean, it's something. It's not too far away, so you know, maybe it's an undertaking that I may consider as well. You mentioned, okay, so whenever we talk about monasteries, obviously we think monastery, monastic, monk, but you also mentioned nuns. Nobody ever says the word convent, but that's a different religious doctrine. So therefore, okay, there are also, I don't mind, if for me it makes no difference, you can have any gender monk, but generally speaking, we associate the term monk with a man. Yes. But there are women there too. Do they have a title? Are they called sister or are they called Adamona?
They are like they are called Ma.
Ma.
Like
okay.
Ma, and then the name.
Okay.
Yeah. So the nuns. It's interesting that you mentioning this nun monk thing, male female. The last time I have been to the monastery was in 2015, and back then I haven't been that aware of the topic or not consciously that aware of the topic of patriarchy, and that changed in the last years. And it like came right back into my face when I was this time there. And so because of course the whole thing is to the outside run by the monks, but in the inside it's the nuns who do a lot of the work, you know, and they don't ever have the chance, a nun does not have the chance to lead, to be the abbot of this kind of monastery, you know. And my observation is that is similar, like within Christianity, because my grand auntie was 40 years part of a convent. She was a nun for her entire life. And so, and I visited her in southern India when she was alive a couple of times. So I also had the opportunity to have an insight there. So I could see that some of the structural, like of the given structure is similar. Yeah.
I mean, there are some lines of Christianity which have female priests or pastors, yes. And so therefore, finally, yeah, is it the Protestant yeah. branch? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, there are. I think there are a couple of others as well, which realize, oh, women can also contribute to human interaction, and so allow women to have important roles within their faith. It still beggars belief that in so many countries that claim human rights or that they claim to share in the principles of human rights and gender equality, that we still have these vast organizations with such potential ability to influence things positively. They remain closed to this real sense of equality and not just spoken.
If you ask me, like, for me, religion is like the fortification of patriarchal structures. Like, and it had been used over the centuries for that, to exclude women. And I, just a note to what you were saying before, to give women important roles, I think that's how you put it. The thing is, I think women have very important roles. What they don't get is the public
recognition
yeah. in the sense that they don't get really to be in the position, like in the
yeah. Sure, sure, of course. You're right to also point out my choice of words leave a lot to be desired. I should also say, because women shouldn't, they're not given something. It's what they deserve to have.
Mm.
And that's also slightly different, because the patriarchal perspective is, I give you your yes. authority, therefore I can take it away. So yes. it's that sense as well. So we have to be careful.
I allow you, yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much, yes. You're we have to be, yeah, I have to be careful as well of these words, not because it's dangerous, but because I don't want to communicate the exact opposite of what I'm complaining
yeah,
about,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's really a challenge with this thing of communicating. I love communication and interaction, and I love to verbalize things and to be in an exchange with others. And said that, I'm also quite conscious about how to put things. That doesn't mean that I always 100% succeed. Far away from that, you know, but I think words create a reality, and that is why it's a well invested effort to see, to check how we speak, how we put things. Yeah,
and also the meaning of some of the verbs that we use. We don't often think about them too much, but these are, you know, every word has the potential to be a microaggression, because we simply don't see them for the inherent meaning and history that they carry with them. And this is not too much perhaps for individual verbs, but especially for proverbs and sayings and things like that, and idioms. We use so many idioms without knowing where they come from. And I mean, there are a couple that people have mentioned to me. For example, I remember reading a tweet from a woman. She was talking about how her boss spoke to her and her colleagues about whipping people into shape. And she said the first thing that I thought, well, it's a standard saying, but she says you can stand there in front of a black person and say you're going to whip them into shape. And that straight away you start thinking, OK, where does this come from?
Yeah.
So we really
same
have
thing
to be,
if you. Yeah. Sorry, just the same thing if you say that in front of a woman as a man.
True. Exactly.
And you get directly. I get directly certain. How you say that? Connections and pictures. Yeah.
And I mean, these are, you know, perhaps that is an established thing, saying your way to say things now without any, we don't even think about where these words come from and what meaning they could have. But for different communities, you mentioned realities before, you know, every community has its history, has its identity and has its own reality, which they carry with them every day.
Yes. And it's not only about examples like this, you know, because of the specific identity we carry. It's also, I had a situation not long ago around the where somebody said to me, "I'm sorry you feel that way." So I had a discussion with another person, and then that person said, "I'm sorry that you feel that way." So from the outside, you look at it, and it seems that it is an apology, but actually it is not. It goes in the direction of gaslighting, because saying, like, if you have an argument between A and B, and that is because something between them happened, you know, and then A says, "I feel like this and this and this," and B says, "Yeah, I'm very sorry that you feel that way." B is not owning his or her part in that interaction, but it's just like throwing it back, you know, "Yeah, like, I'm sorry that, but actually that's your problem, you know, if you feel like that." And I think that many, many people don't realize that. They somehow sincerely think that they're apologizing, which they are actually not. What they are doing is like not taking the responsibility, not owning their own part in it. And I'm mentioning this because around this culture of apologizing, you can see more and more, and I'm really happy about that. It's an approach of enhancing communications between human beings, you know, and that is like the basis of everything. It's like, okay, what would be appropriate apology, actually? What is an apology, you know? I'm very sorry that I made you feel that way, or that something I did made this feeling in you, you know, like something like that. So then we are both in it, you know. It's a whole different, it's me personally, I can feel it on my physical level. If somebody says to me, "I'm sorry that you feel that way," or "I'm sorry that I made you feel that way," or, you know, yeah. Then you are together in it. With the first example, you are being left alone in that situation. So like, yeah, you see how you deal with that. I mean, I don't know how you see that.
Yeah, no, you're right. "I'm sorry you feel that way." They're not actually apologizing for that. They're apologizing, or they're actually pointing out the fact that "I'm sorry for you, that you feel that way. But you're wrong," is what they're saying. When I think about that, and okay, communication is the you know, to use your the verbalization of acknowledging and understanding that you've made a mistake or that you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. But there is something that goes on before you say it. You have to recognize it, you have to internalize it and think about it and reflect. And as you were speaking, I thought to myself, you know, in my life I don't own too many things, but mm-hmm. I definitely, you know, those failures, I own those. You know, I like them. They're mine. They're some of the fewest things that I can actually own. So why shouldn't I?
That's beautifully said. Yeah. And also saying that me being more sensitive to this kind of things doesn't mean that I am, again, that I am capable in a situation where I'm highly activated or triggered, however you want to put it, that I'm capable of doing that. But if you have that knowledge, if you have that understanding, they have something you can always come back to, you know. And I think that is what makes the difference. And I can really tell the difference when I talk to people who have that and people who don't have that. And there's not like one is good and one is bad. It's a lot also about, I mean, it shows also if nobody teaches you that, if you don't know about that, you cannot apply it, you know.
Definitely. And I mean, these are things which come up in everyday life. This is something that we should actually realize. When I communicate, so I've got this mini job at the moment, where I'm involved in communicating with different project partners, and I have certain responsibilities, and I can't always complete those responsibilities. So what are the options open to me? I can, you know, put it under the pillow, sweep it under the carpet and not say anything, or I can own it and contact the partner and say, "Look, I know you're waiting for a response from me. I don't have it for you. So I'm sorry for that. I will get it to you as soon as possible. But people are unwilling to do this. They would rather not communicate, not say a word, leave these people in limbo for weeks on end and think that's a good way of doing things. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I have the same. And you have that in the working field and you have that also in the private field. And what I and I'm really happy and consider myself lucky that I was able to learn exactly that in the field of work. Because there's absolutely no way in the like in the political field, for example, to like that's at least my experience to act like this. And people, I think it's like how we perceive failure and how we want to avoid potential or so-called failure. So if I can't meet a deadline, for example, in a job, I can just keep quiet. But that for me personally, that is like the worst reaction ever. So if I can't meet a deadline, I don't wait until the deadline is passed, you know, and then I might be like, that's the second worst, you know. But what I do is like, I understand 48 hours, 72 hours before that I can't meet the deadline. Then I get in touch with that person. Look, we agreed up on 1, 2, 3. I agreed to deliver that. Unfortunately, I'm not able to. And then also, you know, then the next part is, I can suggest or what I can assure is to deliver to that this and this to that and that, you know, so like being also very constructive and then and to offer the other person something. And for me, this is not failure. There is not anymore like I didn't reach the aim in the class, you know, as you wish. So but it's like an adult way of managing such situation. And it's the same in the private, you know, like easy. Like I am a person, I consider time very, very precious. So I don't mess around with time of other people. So if we have, if we said, okay, Zach, let's meet at 4 p.m. for a coffee and at that gelateria and that coffee at that ice cream place.
Ci sono, ci sono.
Un caffè affogato, eh?
And I
can see that I can't make it for 4 p.m. Then I would let you know as soon as I know that, you know, it's like, okay, look, Zach, I can't make 4 p.m. I'm sincerely sorry. I can be there 4:15, 4:20, 4:30. Is that okay with you? You know, that and that is what I meant before. We don't learn to own the entire us. We learn only to own, or society shows that there is, I mean, it's easy peasy, here we go again, to own the nice things, you know, to own when we have a success, when somebody is happy about what we did, or, you know, that is easy to own. But it's more difficult to own because nobody showed us. And if we are lucky, we learn it by ourselves or with our friends and family is, yeah, we are also, I am also allowed to own my so-called failures, my so-called mistakes, because they are part of who I am, you know. And I had some of the most amazing incidents and connections with people and feeling very close when I was able and capable of owning my shit, actually, you know? So, and then I'm like, oh my God, this person will be so mad. And then I will all be alone and abandoned and all these old things which then come up. And then the other person is like, oh, there's no problem. Thank you for letting me know. And then it's like, oh my gosh, you know, and that keeps me then going to practice that more and more.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, it's also a question of what do we really think when we want to present ourselves as failure free? Yeah, you know, to be at a failure free zone, for me, that is the worst place to be. Yeah, if you pick a place anywhere on the planet which is completely lifeless and full of shit, it's going to be a failure free zone, right? And so you know, why is, if I go to an interview and somebody says to me, okay, Zach, can you tell me, you know, what the biggest mistake you've made over the last 5 or 6 months? And a lot of people try to find ways of turning every mistake into this glorification of the self, you know? And I would be like, dude, how much time do we have? Yeah.
Do you want a list? Come on.
I mean, and if you get the job because the guy person really believes that you haven't made any mistakes, well, after 2 or 3 weeks, they're going to be really disappointed.
Yes. And you are definitely in a job you don't want to be in. It don't fit, because if you get it because you were not honest or you were selling your only certain parts of yourself, you're like not going to be very happy. Just a note to this failure-free zone, and what I think about it, it is so boring. It must be so fucking boring. I wouldn't want to be there. It's something we can be grateful for because it makes us learn.
Which brings us back a bit, because I was thinking about how, because obviously we started with the meditation and and that we knew that's going to branch out into random directions.
Yes.
But to bring it back, when you meditate, you think about, now obviously I'm not expecting you to tell me all of the personal things that you think about, but do you also consider some of the actions that you have taken, some of the things you've said or the things you may have written, and have you reflected upon whether or not those were the best choices or the wisest decisions that you'd made and how you could have done them differently? Are these things that you try to think about, or do you go for the blank my mind completely approach?
Sorry, so the approach would be like to try to blank, but as we are human beings, it's not so easy. So with regard to my personal meditation experience, yes, of course. I mean, meditation, like for me, meditation is to calm my mind. And if I can't, then I can't. Then still, for me, it's not that I failed in meditating. If I sit, like this morning, I did my meditation, and my mind was all over the place. So, but that is how it is. Mm. Punkt. Dot. You know, it's like there's no need to hang myself for that. You know, what is the experience I have in the retreats? That I go through different conditions. So you mentioned before, and I really like that the senses, no, with smell, taste, see, feel, and hear. So, and in the Vipassana, actually my monk teacher said that. So he said, you need to practice self-love. And I was like, okay, yeah, that sounds sexy. That sounds great. I agree. Okay, give me your definition of self-love, you know? So what do you mean by self-love? And he was like, okay, Vipassana considers self-love that you protect yourself, you protect your mind from the things you see, you taste, you feel, you hear, and you smell. In the sense of that you don't allow these experiences to grab on your mind and to hold on to your mind. You should acknowledge them and then try to let them go, because otherwise they bring suffering. You know, like if you smell something nice and then you're like, I like liking, and if you don't have that smell anymore, then you'd like, you want more. So no, there's also suffering, you know, even in the liking. So, and what he said is peacefulness of the mind is behind the conditions. You have the experiences through the senses, which come up in conditions, because the language of the mind is not the words, but the conditions. And you need to be aware of the conditions. And only then you can have a chance to go beyond the conditions. And that is where the peacefulness lies. And I like that very much. And it stuck a lot with me. And I was like, and I'm still chewing and crumbling on that over and over again.
Yeah, I think you just gave us the title of this particular episode as well. So we're going to...
I'm curious.
I'll put that up. Because I've read and listened to the narration of books from people who have a lot of experience in Buddhism, in yogic principles, in teaching and all of these things. And them. Suffering, I seem to recall, suffering plays a significant part of the process. And it's suggestive, is it not, that there is so many religions, they use different words, they use different characters, and yet the at the core of each one is the very same human condition. Our world has deficiencies. Our individual realities have to experience a certain amount of pain and suffering before we can reach any kind of enlightenment thereafter. These are always revisited.
Yeah, I agree. If I would add something with my own words, it's like we are human beings, therefore we are suffering. So like that, it is a part of the experience of being a human being. You know, it's like there is not being a human being without suffering of any kind. And then, of course, like, how do you define suffering? I have like trillions of definition of that. And it's a bit what you also, for me, like in Germany, we would say like it closes the circle. I think it's not proper English. What you said it before works. Is that you only if you walk through your shadows, or if you are aware of your shadows, if you agree that you have shadow parts, that they are also part of you, that they're lovable and they make you, they are part of who you are. Only if we integrate that and accept it and love it, then we can have the full human experience. So for me, actually, it's not to, when I go and meditate, it's not about getting rid of like all the sufferings ever, but to experience how it feels like if the suffering is less, because my mind gets calmer, because that is the only thing where the suffering happens. You know, I mean, it's really interesting. You are closed in the monastery, not talking, not interacting to anybody. And then every time again, I mean, the things are in us, the anger, the sadness, the joy, the jealous, the greed, is all the doubt. It's all in us, but we attribute it always or so often to the other. And it's really, at one point, it's really amusing when I'm then doing my walking meditation or sitting meditation, and I get all upset and all angry about this person or that person or that person. And I'm like, that's funny. That person sits on the other side of the world. I didn't have any contact with that person for like maybe months, years, days, weeks. And I'm like projecting happily my feelings to that person. I mean, I'm happy that I'm at a point where I can see that, not always, not 100%, but more and more often, you know. It's like, yeah, so I am here closed in my kuti or in the meditation hall, and it is in me, you know. It's a crazy experience. And in the same way, these feelings and conditions are in me, the suffering is in me. So that also means I have a chance of how to deal with it by myself, with that. Yeah. This is an amazing piece of knowledge, I'd say.
I can see how therapeutic that could be, understanding this. I think a lot of us, whenever we experience something and when we maintain the capacity to recall and relive those experiences, then we will always maintain the connection with the individuals involved within it. Whether or not we allow ourselves to be dominated by those recollections and by those experiences, or whether or not we allow ourselves to forgive our roles within those experiences, and also to forgive the others at the same time, that will then dictate how we perceive those experiences in the future. I think this is difficult sometimes for everybody to realize.
I love that you, I really sincerely love that you bring up the word of forgiveness. This is another thing my teacher said, told me this year in the retreat. He said, within the relationships with human beings, like in general in relationships, you have two options. One is accepting and one is forgiving. I am still chewing on that one. because I'm like, no, there are also other options, like this, but I really like I, when I have a difficult situation, it's like, okay, Tanya, accepting and or forgiving, and that are like the first step, and then out of this, based on this, you can then decide what to do, you know.
I've heard it from a lot of people who do yoga and go to temples and meditate with this love yourself. And I think a part of loving yourself is accepting yourself. And I think a part of that is also forgiving yourself. And if we can allow ourselves to make our mistakes, to learn from these things, then we become easier for us to live with. But if we are at constant war with our own inability to live failure free, then we cannot be satisfied at all with our output. It's just not possible.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, we can call ourselves blessed, and I can call myself blessed if you have people in your life which show you how you can love yourself through the way they love you. That can be a significant other, that can be family members, parents, siblings, friends. For me, this is a game changer because I do struggle to love myself every now and then. To me, I think that is human. I have times where I'm like, great lady, great. And, and other times I'm like, not that great. And if you then have constantly a small little community around you and people or partner who are telling you, I'm going to love you as long as you love yourself, like, or so, bist du dich liebst, ich liebe dich so lange, bis du dich liebst, you know, like, yeah, until you love yourself. So I try to, and that is like, that is actually a part of what I would call, that's a part of like unconditional love. You know, and that is like really a precious treasure to have in life. And I'm very, very lucky that I have a handful of people who support that. That's nice. And I actually think most of us have. Sometimes we may also look a bit better around to identify that. You know? Because also there is like, we can only have the things which we allow ourselves to have. If I don't allow myself to have somebody in my life who loves me, or who, you know, like, it's difficult to open up for that.
Well, what I find is that you and I can start having a conversation on the color of pomegranates, and we would then be able to communicate philosophically for hours thereafter. I find the ease of our conversation extreme. It's like a warm embrace, our conversation. It's I find it's free. It has a life of its own, and it's always thoroughly entertaining. So, yeah, I just a quick question then. What have you got then planned for the next few months, and when will we do our next podcast? Because you don't need to go on a retreat, just have a podcast with me. I mean, I say the same thing your teacher said, so I mean, you know.
Yeah, I love that. Like, first of all, let me say is I see the same way, and thank you for your really kind words. And I love these kinds of very nourishing exchanges. It's I really value them, and it's that's one of the reasons I always like to come back, and why I'm not scared anymore in which direction the podcast could go. Just go with the flow, and there's always this kind of flow between us, which is really nice. With regard to my coming months, is I'm on a sabbatical still until the end of September, and I don't have any major plans. I still struggle to be back here, but it's definitely not an option, like to go back to Thailand now or to get my backpack and go for another 3 months tour or so. Actually, what I really need to do is to sit down, and I also want to do is to sit down and to see, okay, where do I need to proceed? What do I want to do after that sabbatical? And that is quite pressing. It's pressing within me. It's a wish like, okay, I want to know now. You know, I don't need to know how this all of it unfolds in the next 2 to 5 to 10 years, but I would be really happy to at least know the next 2 to 3 steps, even micro steps. So yeah. And a part of that, I intend to enjoy the summer and life and to spend times with people who I love and who are precious to me. I definitely going to spend some time. I'm going to be in Italy in July for sure. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then see what's coming up. Yeah.
Sure.
Better come over to Berlin, maybe.
There you are. I see. That's what yes. I was going to get to. You
and we can, I don't know. I mean, you are the busy podcaster. I can come back, I don't know, in 2 months or so when we are fully fledged in the summer, and then we can take it from there. I think we will find a way to have the 30th. Yes, 30th.
Yeah, I mean, you've jumped ahead, but yeah, 13th. But
13th, sorry, yeah.
30 is cool. 30 is cool.
30. Yeah. 1-3.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Tanya. It's always great to have you back, and yeah, look forward to the next one.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for having me. Bye bye.
Two, and a mic.